This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by PRMISeattle.com, Primary Residential Mortgage. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Technology.
Well, Frances Haugen is back. This is the Facebook whistleblower. She testified in front of the Congress 2-3 weeks ago or so. But now she's in front of lawmakers in the United Kingdom. And they basically did the exact same thing they did here, although it would appear that she stepped up her criticism somewhat. She is saying that Facebook's refusal to take responsibility for its impact on kids needs to be addressed and in a lot of ways punished. She said they should incentivize their employees to speak up about behavior that is deemed, quote unquote, problematic, that's created by Facebook. Now, when she's talking about Facebook, it's not just Facebook itself. It's really Instagram is a lot of what this has been focused on. Facebook is owns Instagram. Now, she's out here again, and I think it's important to note her background because it can tell you a little bit about her intent. And it doesn't mean that her concerns aren't valid, but she has a history of making these kinds of complaints. She was making similar complaints 6 years ago against Google, saying that Google was not inclusive enough of women. And we also know that she's working with this PR firm that is, he's either the president or he's one of the co-founders. He's a former Obama press aide by the name of Bill Burton, who also works with the Center for Humane Technology, which, again, has a little bit of a conflict here in that it takes on big tech. That's what it's all about, is the criticism. So she's got a background suggesting activism. And again, maybe her points are still completely valid, but it's important to understand her background in that she's also called for some significant oversight in a way that could be deemed censorship. Is that belief of hers fueling how she views some of these documents and experiences coming out of Facebook? Maybe. Maybe not. But let's listen to her. She said today in the UK that what we're experiencing now, and really what young girls are experiencing when using Instagram and Facebook, we're not going to truly understand its impacts until decades from now.
I'm extremely worried about the developmental impacts of Instagram on children. Beyond the fact that if you get an eating disorder when you're 16, you may have osteoporosis for the rest of your life, right? There are going to be women who are walking around this earth in 60 years with brittle bones because of choices Facebook made now.
Now, I'm not entirely sure I believe this notion that having access to photos or videos of women who have a certain body type that is very difficult for most, you know, non-models to actually obtain. I'm not entirely sure I believe that that automatically leads to any kind of eating disorder for the majority of girls. Could it impact some? Yes. But that's not Instagram's problem or fault. A parent needs to be involved. Parents need to be involved. Family, friends need to be involved. That when you are seeing your young daughter or anyone showing signs or symptoms of living with a eating disorder, you can go ahead and blame everything you want. But if they don't have access to those videos or photos on Instagram, they have access to it on TV or in movies or in magazines. Now, I know that there is this general movement coming from the cultural activists on the left talking about how we need to change the way that we portray a woman's body in media. And while they have some point, I don't think that their concerns aren't valid. They've gone to the other side, which is let's have a bunch of morbidly obese folks who are plus size models and we'll pretend that they're 100% the ideal image, which is also not true. You can pretend that all you want. It's the body positivity movement that's pretending being 40 pounds, 100 pounds overweight is healthy. It is not. It is just as unhealthy, maybe even more unhealthy, as someone who is chronically underweight. There is a sort of a compromise of what an average person is that we can say is beautiful and be, you know, correct and accurate in that. without leaning to one side. But at the end of the day, this is not Instagram's doing. People are still posting this content online. So that's more of a conversation that you should be having with your kids as a parent. In fact, that's what I believe with this next quote of hers.
Facebook's own research describes it as an addict's narrative. As an addict's narrative. The kids say, this makes me unhappy. I feel like I don't have the ability to control my usage of it. And I feel that if I left, I'd be ostracized. I am deeply worried that it may not be possible to make Instagram safe for a 14-year-old. And I sincerely doubt it's possible to make it safe for a 10-year-old.
I mean, she's partially right in the sense that it's not safe for anyone, nor is it unsafe for anyone. It is an inanimate object in a way. It's like a rock. You look at that rock and it could be used for good. It could be used for bad. You can throw it at someone and hurt them, or you can use it to defend yourself. Instagram is what you make of it. And if you believe that the content on Instagram that kids are being exposed to or adults are being exposed to is harmful, well, how about this? Instead of telling Instagram people to stop what it is they're doing and just effectively go out of business, why don't you step up and parent? Why don't you have conversations constantly with your kids about what is good or bad body image? What should be viewed and lauded, and what should be viewed and said, well, that's not really what we want to emulate. Why not have those conversations? Why is this on Instagram that all they're doing is putting up a product that people want to go to? People want to go to these products. Is it ultimately harmful for some? Yeah, it is. Which is why parents need to be more involved. But instead of having that conversation, it's all about, we got to take on big tech. You don't always have to take on big tech. You can have conversations, as we are right now, about what's going on, about some of the dangers. You can have conversations with your kids about the dangers. You can have conversations with other parents about best ways to deal with some of the potential dangers and address it that way. But no, activists want to go after big tech. We got to go after big tech. And by the way, there are folks on the right that also want to go after big tech for different reasons. Reasons that I totally understand. And again, big tech, quote unquote, is doing this to themselves. They're the ones putting themselves in these positions because they get political and then it just invites politics. Yeah, shock. I know. But the takeaway from this, yet again, is have conversations with your kids frequently. Have meaningful conversations with them. And you'll be able to spot some of the clear warning signs of someone who is spending too much time online and allowing that to impact the way they think about themselves or others. We acknowledge that as adults. Adults understand the dangers of this. And by the way, let's not pretend that we didn't just go through almost 18 months of putting kids in front of screens and telling them that was normal. Before, we used to say it's lazy parenting just to give your kid a device or put them in front of the TV. Have them go outside. Well, what did we pretend was the case with COVID? Well, number one, we pretended that kids were getting COVID left and right to the point where there were mountains of dead children's bodies piling up on top of each other because of COVID. Then we pretended that going outside could actually spread COVID. Even when we knew going outside transmission is almost impossible, even when we knew that, public health officials pretended otherwise. Keep those kids at home. Keep those kids away from actually having face-to-face interactions with their friends. Keep them out of the schools. Put them in front of that computer. It's the same. And you now are being told, well, you know, being in front of a computer on Instagram is really bad. What about what the teachers in the schools did to these kids? Putting them in front of cameras all day. That had nothing to do with any of this? That had no role to play in their development? Okay, yeah, we got it. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me your text messages. Local tax expert Greg Nunn says the IRS is offering relief options to help those taxpayers affected by COVID-19 who owe the IRS, including those currently in a payment arrangement. Contact Greg at 425-947-1967 or Google N-U-N-N, Nunn Better Tax Resolution. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
Let's turn to Virginia's gubernatorial race. I would argue, and I said this on Friday, that the whole idea that one state or one congressional district or whatever, one race, is a bellwether of things to come, I don't believe that. If you have a lot of specific races that did not go the direction that you thought, okay, that might be something, but one is not really all that meaningful in the grand scheme of things. However, when you look at what's going on specifically in Virginia with this gubernatorial race between Terry McAuliffe and Glenn Youngkin, Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, McAuliffe, the Democrat, very Democrat. When you look at this, there is only an upside for the Republicans. Win or lose, there's only upside. Because Youngkin went into this being told there's no way in the world you can win. No one has a clue who you are. This is Virginia. Biden won Virginia by like 11 points. This is a deeply blue state now. It wasn't always deeply blue, but it's been deeply blue for a very long time. So obviously Glenn Youngkin, especially after Trump, definitely has no chance in the world. And then all of a sudden, Youngkin is in a statistical dead heat with McAuliffe, who is very well known, previous governor. People liked him. But things suddenly have shifted pretty dramatically. That it's now a dead heat. If Youngkin were to lose by 2 points, 3 points, well, the Republicans could sit back and say, well, we were even supposed to be competitive. We were supposed to lose by like 11, 12 points. We picked up on something here in a deeply blue state that could actually tell us, hey, maybe if we identify some of those issues, maybe it's the school issue with CRT, which has become a very big issue in Virginia. Maybe if we take those to the swing districts, where it's a purple district, we could actually win some instead of losing them. And they're going to take whatever the decision is here, whatever the ultimate result is, they're going to take all of what they learned, the Republican Party nationally, to those very, very specific races that could go either way. Now, if they win, bam, even though I don't believe it is a bellwether, the media will, and the media will say that. This is a guy who wasn't supposed to win. Winning, oh my gosh, things are changing. And that will force the Democratic Party to rethink their strategy, maybe put more money into races they otherwise wouldn't. Because let's be honest, if a deep blue state of Virginia can flip, they're going to start looking to other deeply blue states and start to put a little bit more money there when otherwise they would not have. So that all is good for the Republican Party. So win or lose, there are positives for the Republicans. Obviously more positive if he were to win. But this is still a good picture if it's a close loss. And that's why Terry McAuliffe, who's very nervous now, is calling in the big guns. Former President Barack Obama was there over the weekend. And it was interesting because I was told by CNN and MSNBC, suddenly they're not saying this anymore, but I was told that speculating that an election could be stolen, that's not just anti-democratic, but it could kill democracy as we know it. How dare Donald Trump? How dare he question the elections? He's going to ruin democracy as we know it. This country will fall apart because he said things we don't like. And yet, Obama goes there and says this.
And if you've got good ideas, people will flock to your ideas, but that's not what they try to do. Instead, you're trying to rig elections.
Rig elections? They're cheating?
Because the truth is people disagree with your ideas. And when that doesn't work, you start fabricating lies and conspiracy theories about the last election, the one you didn't win. That's not how democracy is supposed to work.
Interesting. Hey, Terry McAuliffe, what do you think about the Georgia election with Stacey Abrams?
She would be the governor of Georgia today had the governor of Georgia not disenfranchised 1.4 million Georgia voters before the election.
Weird.
That's what happened to Stacey Abrams. They took the votes away.
Was that a conspiracy theory coming from a person who's desperate because he doesn't have any real ideas? Defending someone else who didn't really have any real ideas? Isn't he doing exactly what Obama said was desperate and shouldn't be done? Isn't Terry McAuliffe doing exactly what CNN spent months on when Trump did it? And Trump had a hell of a lot more evidence of inconsistencies, not of a stolen election. It wasn't stolen, but there were obvious inconsistencies and very clear changes. He had more evidence than Stacey Abrams does, who still, by the way, won't concede. She's still pretending that she won. She didn't. Isn't it weird that Democrats are silent on this? Not when Trump does it, but when Terry McAuliffe does it, when Obama does it, claiming that the only way Republicans can win is when they cheat, which I love that. I love that line so much. Why then don't we always cheat? If it's really as simple as just cheat and you'll win an election, could we maybe start cheating here in Washington? Can we get a little bit more Republicans? I know we don't have to cheat on every single one because then it would be so obvious, but it sounds like it's obvious now. I mean, Barack Obama knows. How'd he figure it out? So everyone is cheating when Republicans win. When Democrats win, nothing went wrong. They just overcame the cheating. Oh, okay. Or maybe there was no cheating either way and you just lost an election. Media, for the most part, is silent. CNN covered this briefly today, and the way that they covered it, treated it just as a news item, almost like that they were agreeing with it. They won't dare call up Terry McAuliffe. They're not going to call him out. Why? Because they want him to win. They know what's on the line. They don't want Republicans to win. But I'm assuming, though, if Youngkin loses, it was rigged. Or no, it wasn't rigged. Okay, sorry. You're giving me that look. I don't know what their rules are. They change them all the time. So Republican loses, Democrats didn't cheat, Republicans win, then Republicans cheated. Okay, that definitely makes sense. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The sports ball.
So Ravens are a team in the NFL, which is football. And they're based in Baltimore. And they had a football game over the weekend. And they won? You don't even know. You can use your microphone. It's okay. Well, so I can humiliate you, Mr. Sports Guy over there in your Seahawks jersey, pretending that you care about the NFL.
I care about the Seahawks.
So Ravens played some game, and we don't know if they won or lost. Doesn't matter. Because at one point during the radio broadcast, some fan who was drunk tried to get into the booth. And it was very, very weird how it all played out.
Tyler Boyd has it for a short gain out to the 34-yard line. Again, impressive coverage by Anthony Avery.
What are you doing?
Okay. What are you doing? And they went silent for a hot second. And then they continued on with the play, with the call.
Show must go on.
But you're not going to respond to the very panicked, what are you doing?
How do you reason with a drunk person?
No, on air! Fans were listening to this. They were like, what happened? What just happened? Is
true
everything okay?
True football fans would salute that person.
Well, they finally address it, but after they get into a call.
And six.
They're just pretending nothing just happened.
Burrow in the shotgun. Ravens bunch six along the defensive front. Burrow takes the snap. Blitz pressure coming. He's flushed in the pocket.
Okay, you're going to get to the whole,
side.
Is the other guy okay?
Broken up incomplete at the 40-yard line. T. Higgins was the target.
Scared?
Anthony Averett had great coverage, and that is going to force the punt team on. If you were listening, you heard Femi say, what are you doing? What are you doing? He was not talking to the players or the coaches.
I know.
We actually had a fan who was trying to climb into the broadcast booth. She said, I'm a veteran, and I'm looking for a drink.
Yeah, I don't serve drinks at the game. I might make some cocktails at home, but this is not the right time or place.
Okay. You had all that time to come up with a way better response, and that's what you went with. What was funny is when I first saw this story, I thought the woman came in through the door, not climbing into the thing. And I was going to say, because I've worked in plenty of press boxes at Lumen Field, you can get in very easy. There's usually one, maybe 80-year-old, like it's an octogenarian who's just
walk on
you
through.
Can literally just walk in and be like, oh, hey, I'm good.
Just show a fake badge. But hey, man,
I don't even need to show a badge. I've walked in, maybe because they recognize me, but I've definitely seen people just kind of walk in. They're all old. They don't care.
Maybe I gotta try this out.
You literally just walk through. There's no security. It's very, believe me, if you wanted to get in, you can get in very, very easily. You shouldn't, obviously, because then cops will show up or security will show up, and then you'll be beaten to a bloody pulp. And then you'll never do that again.
Eh.
I was just looking for a beer. Okay, we got it. I love she climbs in looking for booze.
It's a true fan right there.
Is it?
Yeah. You're not drinking at a football game. What are you doing?
I mean, she knew she got the beer from somewhere else in the past. I mean, how slosh was she?
But the good stuff is always upstairs.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair, actually. Fair enough. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. 1-800-465-8770.
Yelp, Tacoma, Bremerton, Bothell.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Rance Show.
Redmond, Sumner, Kent.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at that. 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local, brought to you by Alpine Specialty Cleaning and alpineclean.com. This is the part of the show where we completely ignore the stories coming out of Seattle. And instead, we focus on the stories in the communities you live in and care about most. We start in Mill Creek, but really, this is bigger than Mill Creek. But their police department, like so many others in this state and frankly in this country, are dealing with a staffing crisis. And they find themselves in a position that could be reasonably described as desperate for qualified officers. With that in mind, Councilmember Vincent Cavallari, who's going to be on the show at about 5:10 today, he advertised in a Facebook post that the city, quote, will not be mandating a vaccine to anyone of our personnel. And then he offered to fast track a lateral move of those interested in the job. Lateral moving, meaning you're moving from a different agency. And this is, of course, presuming you qualify, depending on what your background happens to be for the position, if you have any demerits or whatever against you. So it's funny because it felt like in a piece today in the Daily Herald, the Everett Herald, that they were offended in some way, that this was somehow controversial for him to say. But is it controversial? I'm pretty sure it's the same that I believe it's Cassie Franklin, Everett mayor, has said with the PD there. I think I'm certain that it's the same as the chief of police in Marysville. He's told people who lost their job, troopers who lost their job here in Washington State over the vaccine mandate, to apply for the more than a dozen open positions in his department. I know that on the east side, Spokane County Sheriff came out, posted a Twitter video, a recruitment video, saying they're not going to mandate vaccination. Please come work for us. So I'm not entirely sure I get why this is controversial in the least. Why is this controversial? Are they bad police officers because they chose not to submit their papers to the state? Because they chose not to get a vaccine that might not be necessary for them, given the fact that they might have had COVID already and recovered even recently, which gives them natural immunity? Is it controversial to say that they have a religious conviction that they don't want to violate because it might please Governor Jay Inslee, who doesn't care about religious people and their convictions? Not in this, at least. Not at all. I think all these police departments need to do whatever they can to recruit good officers. And I can tell you this, in the city we don't talk about during this segment, they've got over 100 that are going to be out of a job soon. Really good officers who you should be working really, really hard to recruit. Meanwhile, the current mayor and the former mayors of Bellingham, they published an editorial in the Bellingham Herald about Initiative 4 that's on the ballot there in the city. And they're saying, don't vote on this one. Vote no on this one. Do not support this. Vote no on Initiative 4. And I 100% agree with them. Initiative 4 essentially says, okay, you have to guarantee weeks in advance a schedule for your employees. And this is, of course, for directly would impact part-timers or workers in retail or restaurants. You got to guarantee them a finalized schedule weeks in advance, and you would guarantee hazard pay anytime a state of emergency is declared, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the impacts on the city of Bellingham. And so they write in this op-ed, quote, it would remove flexibility when we all need it most. It would add hazard pay for state emergencies that have no impact on our area, and those factors combined with both would both reduce public services and increase costs for families. And the hardest hit will be marginalized people in our community. Now, going into this a little bit more in detail, $4 an hour hazard pay for all these workers during a pandemic or state emergency, whatever that happens to be. But let's assume that it was another pandemic, for example. So at the time where businesses would be struggling the most, you would then burden them with an extra $4 an hour pretending that it's dangerous to work. We still, in certain cities like the one we don't mention, or in Burien, that's another one, they've got this hazard pay in effect. We are pretending that going to the grocery store is a hazard. What's the number of cases that have come out of the grocery? Oh, not many. There haven't been a surge. I mean, we just fired a whole bunch of people for not getting vaccinated, and you're telling me they can go to a grocery store unvaccinated, just in a mask? And it's how dangerous? Oh, no, but no surge. Okay, no surge. Got it. Guaranteed schedule for hourly workers 2 weeks in advance. So you're supposed to tell an employee 2 weeks in advance. Let's say you're a restaurant. We've got a big party coming in a week and a half. I need you on the shift. Is that cool? Okay, great. And then 3 days later, they cancel. And you don't need that person there anymore. You're in a position now as a restaurateur. Well, I'm just going to have to pay you. You're not going to really do anything. Why don't you just stay home and I'll give you the paycheck? That makes sense to you in a business that already has razor-thin margins? That makes sense? What about if things change? What if there is an emergency and you need more staff, but you didn't give them a 2 weeks notice about an emergency that just happened at the last minute that you obviously didn't know about? They say good faith estimates of weekly hours for new employees. Who argues what's good faith? Because I would bet that someone who doesn't get the hours that they thought they deserved would argue it wasn't given to you in good faith. And then they say compensation for schedule changes without sufficient notice. The whole, look, if you don't want to work in an industry that has this kind of scheduling, don't work in that industry because it has that kind of scheduling. It's truly that simple. You don't have to be a waiter. You don't have to be a barista. You don't have to be a retail worker at some clothing shop. You don't have to do that. You're making a choice. You have low skills. We have to be honest. Someone who works at a retail shop has low skills. Or you're basically working beneath your skill level. It does not take a bunch of skills to type in a number into a computer that tells you how much money is owed and then tells you exactly how much to give back. It does not take a whole lot of skills to properly fold a shirt or put clothing on a hanger. It doesn't mean it's not important. Obviously, it needs to get done. But you don't have a whole bunch of skills. And so in place of hiring someone for jobs that require a whole bunch of skills, they have these low-skilled jobs, and there are some trade-offs. We're still going to pay you, and we're going to pay you really, really well, given what you do for this company. However, yeah, sometimes shifts are going to change at the last minute, and we can't really know what that's going to look like. That is life. I swear, folks, this is a millennial thing. They want everything handed to them. They don't want to actually have to work for anything. They think they're above work. Meanwhile, the people who do bust their tails in and out of an office working late into the night, they end up seeing way, way, way more success than the people who complain like this. Oh, you didn't tell me my shift a month and a half in advance? Oh. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Obviously, a lot of Seattle firefighters, up to 75 or so, are awaiting their fate, much like the situation with the Seattle Police Department. These are firefighters who chose not to comply with the COVID vaccine mandate, and rather than be fired on the spot, they're kind of in this limbo as the process moves forward as to whether or not the city will have a change of heart and decide to accommodate. At the end of the day, though, it means all of these firefighters are not actually working. So how bad is the situation, and how much money is being spent on overtime just to accommodate all of these firefighters who are out? Joining me on the line with his take, serving on his personal capacity here, is Seattle Fire Department Lieutenant Jeff Vail. Lieutenant Vail, welcome back to the show. over the weekend, obviously you guys have been a little bit busy just because of some of the emergencies that happened, but I'm told that over the weekend there were more rigs that were taken offline or medic units that were taken offline. What can you tell us?
Yeah, thank you, Jason, for having me on. It's good to be here again. Yeah, this weekend, I know there were staffing shortfalls and what we call browned out rigs. I don't have the exact numbers for you on that, but what I have got some harder numbers are on are the number of firefighters hired to fill in for the folks like myself that are in this accommodation process, which is really just a charade by the city so that they don't get sued for denying exemptions. So Saturday, Sunday, and today, they have hired firefighters, lieutenants, and captains, and paramedics on overtime between 60 and 80 per shift, conservatively. There was already a bunch of overtime every single shift in the city of Seattle as they were behind on staffing. And now with, you know, between 70 and 80 of us out either already fired or in the process of being fired, that overtime is through the roof, and they're spending conservatively $100,000 a day just to cover the overtime shifts that are created by these vacancies that the city has created.
So help me understand, when you say they've hired these folks, what does that mean? Are they not...
Yeah, that's just the way we term it. That doesn't mean necessarily they're hiring new employees. That's what we call when you get called for overtime because there's a vacancy. You are already a Seattle firefighter who is meant to be off that day. They call you and they hire you to work that shift to fill a vacant seat. And so they have called and, like I said, hired or put 60 to 80 firefighters in those vacant seats who would normally be off that day, and they're paying them time and a half to do so, and that equates to conservatively $100,000 a day in overtime that's totally unnecessary.
And the calculation that you're coming up with on the pay is just the average pay of a firefighter times 1.5.
Yep, and they're long shifts, right? They're 24-hour shifts. So, and you've got paramedics who get paid more. You've got lieutenants who get paid more than the average firefighter. You've got captains who get paid even more than the average firefighter. And then you have the regular firefighter. So, yeah, I'm ballparking that average, and that's why I say conservatively $100,000 a day is what they're approximately looking at right now over the weekend and today. And that number will be let me tell you, too, Jason, that they have created a new memorandum of agreement called, quote-unquote, staffing crisis. And so they recognize on paper they've created a staffing crisis, and now they're bending and breaking all the rules that we had before, letting people work 72 hours in a row, letting people who are not normally drivers get a quick crash course in training and start driving, all kinds of things because they recognize that they've created a mess, and this is how they're filling it. And so that overtime number will go up as people burn out. You can only sustain working 72 hours extra overtime, all this for a while, and then those numbers will go even higher.
Based on your experience, Lieutenant Vail, how long before burnout typically occurs? And I know it's different depending on the person and if there's a major emergency that's taking a lot out of someone, but just in a general sense, when do you think that fatigue starts to connect?
Yeah, I mean it's gray, like you said. I'm just speculating, but I would guess within the next month to 6 months, you'll start to see burnout. I mean, there was a lot of burnout already because people were working a ton of overtime just to keep staffing levels normal before this. And I think right now there's this like call to action. The firefighters love their city and want to make sure that no rigs are browned out, but it was starting to wane already, and now that you put this extra pressure, I can only imagine it'd be weeks or months before it starts waning again, and then you're going to even greater, canceled units, emergency units.
Seattle Fire Lieutenant Jeff Vail joining me on the line. He's speaking in his personal capacity. He's also a member of the union leadership, talking about the situation that a lot of firefighters find themselves in here in the city of Seattle, where at least 75 or so have been put on their version of the unavailable list, which means they are just off duty, not allowed to work because they did not comply with the vaccine mandate. It seems very clearly that they're going to be fired. It's just a question of when that happens. You're saying, Lieutenant, that it's basically going to take a couple weeks at least. That's generally the sense that we've been getting from the city. What does this ultimately mean for public safety?
Ultimately, for public safety, it means a lot of wasted money of the city's, of the taxpayers' dollars. It means increased response times and less efficient units because you have people working out of positions that they're normally in. In my opinion, it makes the fire department much worse. And, you know, all to mitigate a risk that was never a statistical reality. We had we had zero documented cases of a firefighter giving COVID to a patient, and we had zero documented cases of a patient giving COVID to a firefighter that were none that were confirmed, and not really any that were suspected. And you know, most of our firefighter to firefighter exposures, the vast majority of them were from vaccinated people. So you haven't really even improved the in the station exposure list either.
And Chief Scoggins, I haven't heard him speak to that final point, but he's confirmed your first 2 points, which was there were no confirmed cases of firefighter to public, and there was one case of public to firefighter. And the only reason that he says things are changing as far as the policy is just because the policy is changing. Literally, there's nothing that's changed on the ground or in the public or with COVID. It's just that this is a new policy and they're going to follow it. Are you on the list of officers who are taken out of rotation?
Yes, sir. I'm on. I am on the quote unquote accommodation process. And yeah, I will be fired. They've made it very clear they're not going to accommodate anybody.
How have they made it clear?
Chief Scoggins has said that verbally, and people have already begun receiving. We already received
yes, everyone has already received those initial letters that say, hey, you've lacked accommodation. And by the way, that's the same for the Seattle Police Department. Now you're going, and why you're calling it a charade is that you're now going through this extra process where someone else looks at it and might overturn it, but you're saying they've given no indication that they're going to overturn anything.
Absolutely, yeah. And some of the people have been through this process a little bit faster. Other people are, you know, in the process of using different leaves and whatnot. So everybody's on a little bit of different timeline. It's hard to say how long that'll be for people. But the people who are on the more truncated timeline have already received registered mail letters saying, we were not able to accommodate you. You came back with your suggestions. We still say we're not able to accommodate you. And they've gotten their letters saying that, you know, within 2 weeks you'll be terminated.
Any regrets on your position?
Oh, absolutely not. No. I cry every day. This is a lifestyle and a career and a family that I'm losing. But based on my beliefs, I can't get the shot, and this is to me as much of a much bigger fight than just my job and my pension, and I have millions of dollars to lose here. This is a fight for freedom, for my children, for America, and I don't think that's an overstatement at all.
I don't either. I'm glad you're fighting it. It's a tough spot for anyone to be in, and I understand why someone might just give in and say, I can't because of my situation with my family. I'm just not able to do it. Other people are in different positions and make different decisions. I'm glad there's some people who are standing up to this, not because I'm anti-vax. I'm vaccinated. It's because I'm anti-mandate, and it is ludicrous that we're doing this not just to you and your colleagues, but ultimately we're doing this to the city of Seattle and its residents. People are less safe as a result of this. So we wish you the best of luck, and we'll continue to stay in touch as this story progresses.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jason. I appreciate the opportunity. And let me really quickly echo what you're saying. I'm not vaccinated versus unvaccinated. For me, there's God created one race. It's called the human race. And I am not about dividing. And I love all my vaccinated and unvaccinated brothers and sisters in the fire department and in the human race. So I want to make that clear.
Lieutenant Jeff Vail of the Seattle Fire Department, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. One more hour coming up after this.